podcast where we discuss the inspiration behind your favorite horror films, lore, gore, and every kill in between.
Slayers, welcome back. I'm your host, E.L. King, and
in this episode, I'm reviewing the groundbreaking sci-fi horror film Alien that birthed the Xenomorph with ID at Xbox community manager and ultimate horror nerd, horror fan, Timber. Timber, welcome to Slay Away.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here. How's it going?
Me too. Yeah. I'm so excited. It's going great. Are you ready to chat horror with me today?
Oh, I've been ready. This is a long time coming and I am ready for it.
I'm so excited because it's funny, we've known each other for a little while all through social media. And we're finally actually talking for the first time. Yeah, we're talking about Alien.
It's so funny. I mentioned that to my partner. I was like, you know, we've been in the same circles on social media, but I don't know what her voice sounds like.
Yeah, we live in the same city too. It's like the weirdest thing. Well, can you tell everyone a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. I'm Timber. I work at ID at Xbox doing community work for independent games. So I love all things indie. And I've also been a longtime horror fan from the time my mother dragged me to Jurassic Park, where I hid under the seat when the T-Rex came out, from watching a movie about killer evil cats and then crying when the protagonist got revenge on the cats, and only being happy when my mom told me, don't worry, there's still evil kittens. Like the movie ends with like a hopeful, like an evil song, like, don't worry, there's kittens. It's from nightmares to, you know, my sleep paralysis. It's just always been a part of me. And I'm so excited to share some of that passion with people who love horror too.
Awesome. Well, I'm so glad you're here. And I was really excited when you reached out to me when I think I either we were talking and I was like, hey, do you like horror films, by the way? I should just ask you, because I was like, this, you know, because at the time I was just getting this podcast started and I was kind of talking with people I know and saying like, hey, I don't know if you like horror, because it's not always something that people really just put out there. Whereas now I'm leaning into it and it's literally all I ever talk about. But when we brought it up, I was really excited. And then we got into this conversation about the Ripley character. And so why is it that you love this film?
There's so many reasons. Not only is there so many reasons from when I was younger. I think the first time I saw this film, I was maybe 11 or 12. My mom did not shield me from this stuff. and then watching it as an adult and as a teenager, it's always, I've always come away with a different context from it, which is one of the big reasons. I mean, I can't think of many horror or any medium that I can say that really about. And I find that Alien as a film is very unique in that way for me. So I love that about it. I love Ripley. She was such a role model. I'm a queer non-binary person. And so I think that always spoke to me with Ripley, because they did just such a cool job. And we spoke a little bit about this before the podcast, and it really got me thinking about it all over again. That they made characters. They made characters. They didn't fit anyone into any sort of binary. Ripley was just Ripley, and she was kick-ass. And, you know, that really, really spoke to me when I was younger. And even now as an adult, you know, I watched it again with my friends. We had like a panel discussion throughout the film. And even now that still spoke to me as an adult, how unique the characters were, especially for the time and even now. So.
Some of you may have figured out we're not home yet. We're only halfway there. Mother's interrupted the course of our journey.
Why?
She's programmed to do that should certain conditions arise. They have.
Like what?
Seems she has intercepted a transmission of unknown origin. She got us up to check it out.
What kind of a transmission?
Acoustical beacon that repeats at intervals of 12 seconds. SOS.
I don't know.
Human.
Unknown.
Can't see a goddamn thing.
Ash, can you see this?
I've never seen anything like it.
Looks like a warning.
Chances, but you have my sympathies.
As far as Alien goes, getting into the plot, Alien, if you don't know, is a science fiction horror film released on May 25th, 1979, and it was directed by Ridley Scott. So Ridley Scott has actually directed a few of my favorite horror or fantasy films, because
Mine
Legend
too.
Is another big one for me.
Yes, absolutely. That's probably one of my very favorites too.
Yeah, it's one of my absolute favorites. So in this film, in deep space, the crew of the commercial starship vessel Nostromo is awakened from their cryo sleep capsules halfway through their journey home to investigate a distress call from an alien vessel. So the terror begins when the crew encounters a nest of eggs inside an alien ship, and an organism from inside the egg leaps out and attaches itself to one of the crew members, causing him to fall into a coma before hatching what we now know to be the xenomorph, this perfect, terrifying alien creature with acid for blood and no shortage of ways to kill its prey. So, yeah, I'm curious, as far as anyone listening, you know, I want to know, what do you think of the film? What are your thoughts on Alien? If you can send us your thoughts and feedback, email us at slayawayradio@gmail.com, or you can send us a note on Twitter at slayawayradio. So I do want to also jump into the backstory and the reception of the film. And there's a lot to unpack, because there's a lot of different stuff going on here. But
there's a lot, yeah.
Yeah, the screenplay for Alien was written by Dan O'Bannon. And it was actually based on a story that he wrote with Ronald Shusett. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I'm sorry, Ronald.
Close enough.
Yeah, it's like we're there. So the film stars Tom Skerritt, who plays Dallas, Sigourney Weaver, who plays Ellen Ripley, who's also I think the only character that has a full name, which is, it adds to the non-binariness of the whole thing. Veronica Cartwright, who plays Lambert, Harry Dean Stanton, who plays Brett, John Hurt, who plays Kane, Ian Holm, who plays Ash, and Yaphet Kotto, who plays Parker. So it was produced by Gordon Carroll, David Giler, and Walter Hill through their company Brandywine Productions. And then it was distributed by 20th Century Fox. So what I had read is that apparently 20th Century Fox did not express a lot of confidence with financing a science fiction film, which I think that was probably pretty common at the time. But then Star Wars released in 1977, and after the success of that film, the studio's interest in the genre just like skyrocketed, and they wanted to act really fast in the interest on science fiction, and Alien just happened to already be on their desk. It was the only script they had, so they greenlit the project for the $4.2 million.
Wow. You know, that makes a lot of, it's so funny you mentioned Star Wars and that. It basically opens as Star Wars, and it didn't hit me until I was watching it last night.
With the when you watch and it's the ships, you just get that opening shot of the ship in space.
Yeah,
it's such a common thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh my goodness, wait a minute. Is Ridley Scott just a big nerd? Like, it really felt like, you know, watching it, I was like, I think he just really loves Star Wars, because there's a lot of that angle that you see in Star Wars that makes everything look more foreboding and sinister than, you know, it's a model, but it's all about the angles. And then they do the same thing in Alien.
Slightly different soundtracks, but I think they go in that same direction. And that opening shot, it really is very similar, but what I have to say for Alien is their opening sequence with the title credits is, like, super iconic, and I don't know if anybody's done anything quite like that before, and it was intentionally done that way to make it really foreboding, which I liked a lot, so.
Give me goosebumps watching it, every without fail, like that, just the way everything, and it's very patient storytelling, and I think that's what lends, like, everything's so slow, you can't help but be like, oh, what's gonna happen, and then, like, an N appears, it's just a letter, but it's, like, yeah. Just, you hold your breath.
And I'm one of those people, graphic design, background-wise, that I'm very into, you know, font, but in writing the script, O'Bannon drew inspiration from many previous works of science fiction and horror, and he has been stated as saying that he didn't steal Alien from anybody, but he stole it from everybody. So I thought that was interesting. And this is actually a film that we talked about previously on the podcast. He drew inspiration from The Thing from Another World that came out in 1951, and that actually inspired the idea of, you know, professional men being pursued by a deadly alien creature through this, like, claustrophobic environment. He drew inspiration from Forbidden Planet. It gave him the idea of a ship being warned not to land and then the crew being killed one by one by a mysterious creature when they defy the warning. Now, in this case, I think they changed the warning to a distress signal. I don't know that it was a warning or that the crew was not informed it was a warning, because Ash is the only one that knew the message, I believe,
right.
The android character.
Yeah, it was interesting. They set it up, and another reason why I love Alien is they set it up as a corporate. Mm-hmm. It's in their contract. They forfeit their shares if they don't check out the SOS, which is just so sinister to be like, if they just, you know, was like, you know what, it's not worth it. But instead, they were kind of corporately forced into that direction.
They expand on that in Aliens, which I like a lot. He also drew inspiration from Planet of the Vampires, which is, I believe, an Italian horror film from Mario Bava. And that contains a scene in which the heroes discover a giant alien skeleton, and this influenced the Nostromo's crew discovery of the alien creature in the derelict spacecraft. So, and then we hearken back to that when we watch Prometheus, like, in 2012, several years later. So O'Bannon, he also has noted the influence of Junkyard from 1953. Now, that's not something I'm familiar with, but it's a short story by Clifford D. Simak, in which a crew lands on an asteroid and discovers a chamber full of eggs. So I was like, yeah, that's the most real fun part.
Yeah, right.
And he also has cited influences with Strange Relations by Philippe Jose Farmer from 1960, which covers alien reproduction and various EC Comics horror titles carrying stories in which monsters eat their way out of people. So you gotta love, I guess, young male writers in this time period and their influences from either comics or horror films and science fiction at the time, and, like, maybe Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, they're big into it. I mean, and it makes sense. I mean, you even have, like Neuromancer, I would say, is probably another really big one.
I think they reference Neuromancer as well. Yeah.
And it's funny because when I watched it last night, I was like, wow, this is such a time capsule in a film. Like, you could feel that era of not just filmmaking and the breaking of basically all the rules while filming Alien, which I'm sure we'll get, like, there's some wildly filmed sequences, but it really is just, like, a nice little slice of both that era and that era as film. It's very, it's just incredible to see. I was like, wow, I'm getting, I wasn't born in this period and I'm so nostalgic for it suddenly, like down to the music. You can feel just every influence that they had writing the script, I think, just in each part. And that's, I think, what gives it that unique time capsule feel. You know the era it's from. But yeah, I didn't realize how vast also the influences were. I thought it was like here and there, but that's...
It's a lot.
It's deep. It runs deep.
And then, so the alien and its accompanying artifacts were designed by Swiss artist H.R. Geiger. So a lot of people probably know the name, while concept artists Ron Cobb and Chris Foss designed the more human settings. And the setting, both on the ship and the alien planet, are what we've come to expect when watching sci-fi horror films, I think. So, and we get them, I think, referenced in small ways in other films, or it's like any alien planet you go to is going to be sort of like dark, a little desolate, sort of like a flip on a sunny desert. It's like a desert wrapped in darkness and cold tones versus Mars, for example, wrapped in sand, sunshine, according to The Martian. But I don't know. So Alien was actually filmed over 14 weeks from July 5th to October 21st in 1978. And principal photography took place at Shepperton Studios near London, while the model and miniature filming was done at Bray Studios in Water Oakley, Berkshire. So I didn't realize so much of the film was shot in the UK.
You know, I always assumed it was like Hollywood. I just
just soundstage stuff. Yeah. So but the production schedule was really short because the film had a lower budget. And there was a lot of pressure from 20th Century Fox to finish on time because of, I think, the hype around science fiction at the time. And Alien ended up, like I said, premiering May 25th, 1979. And this will be fun for us because its opening night was at the 4th Seattle International Film Festival. And it was presented in 70mm at midnight and had its wide release in the U.S. on June 22nd. So I did not realize it premiered here in the Seattle area.
No, it's a very Seattle film. Now that you put it in that context, I'm like, yeah, that probably tracks for the premiere.
Oh, yeah, I could see that. It was probably a blast. And I'm just curious which – I need to look into it a little bit more. I didn't look up the history to see, well, which – theater did it premiere at. There's that theater that's up on Queen Anne that they tend to do a lot of independent film festival premieres at, and I think that's where the Seattle International Film Festival is usually hosted. Of course, it's the Seattle International Film Festival Cinema Uptown. So I've been there before, and it's a fantastic theater. And yeah, the SIF is sort of a staple here in the Seattle area, and so a lot of the International Film Festival stuff for like great kind of films that don't have wide releases will usually show up there. So it is closed temporarily.
Oh, just temporarily though. We're
it's
good.
An art house movie theater. Yeah. Upon its initial release, Alien was banned to younger audiences because the monster was thought to be too sexy and presented a perverse view of reproduction. So when it was released in 1979, the film was given an X certificate in line with other horror films of the time. So this was before PG-13 as a rating existed. And I believe the film is rated PG-13 now.
No, I mean, yeah, no, I can see that. For today's, yeah. Oh, wow. It feels like it should be rated R.
It's still rated R, but by today's standards, it's PG-13.
Oh, wow. Oh, I don't know why that makes me feel so old. I'm clutching my pearls.
When I look at it, I'm like, yeah, by today's standards, it's probably PG-13, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
there's actually pretty minimal gore. There's no sex.
Yeah.
No actual sex.
Yep. It's explicit. It's like explicitly inexplicit, which is really interesting. I was thinking about that. Like, oh, they really didn't. I had remembered the film being so much more graphic, and it's really very coy about the themes, which is interesting. It's scary. For me, it's scarier that way. I don't need to see the whole thing, but if you give me a little.
Well, and that's intentional.
Yeah, absolutely.
One interesting thing about this film is that horror films are usually snubbed when it comes to award season. But Alien was actually met with quite a bit of critical acclaim and box office success. And it actually won the Academy Award for Best Visual Effects. Of course, they didn't look at the performances. They only care about the effects. But it did also get 3 Saturn Awards, one for Best Science Fiction Film, Best Direction for Ridley Scott, and Best Supporting Actress for Cartwright. So it did win some awards during award season. And the film has been consistently praised in the years since its release and is considered one of the greatest films of all time. So in 2002, Alien was deemed culturally, historically, and aesthetically significant by the Library of Congress and was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry.
That's really cool.
Kind of a big deal.
That's a huge deal. When we're all gone, Alien will remain. That's how they'll think it happened. They'll be like, oh, this thing must have gone on Earth. It was a nightmare for them.
The success of Alien spawned a media franchise of films, as we know, and also novels, comic books, video games, and toys. And it also launched Sigourney Weaver's acting career. It was her first lead role in a film. She previously was a stage actress, so the story of her character's encounters with the alien creatures became the thematic narrative, you know, in the core of all the sequels. So that's a big break for her at the time.
Wow, what a gift we were given.
Unknown in film. Given a huge gift. Sigourney Weaver is amazing. I absolutely love her. It's always fun when she makes a cameo in other like horror or sci-fi films.
Oh, you love to see it. Yeah.
Yeah, you do. And the thing with, you know, games, and I think Alien was getting attention again more recently because of the release of Alien Isolation and the newer Alien films that came out with Covenant and coming out, you know, after Prometheus came out. Like Covenant was quite a while after Prometheus came out, but Alien Isolation was a fantastic game, and it's about the Amanda Ripley character, which is only referenced in Aliens, I believe.
Yeah, it's like very briefly, because I think it's like set, you know, it's set, you know, hundreds of years in the future, and I think that it's like a footnote, like, well, you don't have a daughter anymore that we gave you for only this one line, and then that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, something like that.
It's super, super brief.
I feel like maybe now I don't remember it coming up in Alien, and I could be wrong. I think it only comes up in Aliens because they want to set up this whole maternal instinct thing with her and the Newt character.
Yeah, it's not mentioned at all. I don't even think the character, from my understanding,
it's like an add-on to make the sequel work, or that motherly bond, or that natural maternal instinct for her, which she goes from being a very non-maternal type character, or to like all of a sudden she's like,
I must protect
very
this child.
Motherly, and it's a twist, but I don't think that it hurts her character in how we think of her in Alien, because I think of I don't think of them in the same breath necessarily.
No, I agree. I mean, and the themes are quite a bit different. Just I think in general, the escalation of from Alien to Aliens is, I think, pretty significant. And Ridley Scott, from my understanding, didn't necessarily think it would have a sequel. And when you watch Alien, it feels like a complete story. It never really needed that. As much as Aliens is one of my favorite, you know, films. Alien was very complete in its story, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And so the creature effects in Alien are super incredible. I think we all can agree. O'Bannon introduced Scott to the artwork of H.R. Giger. Both of them felt that his painting Necronom 4 was the type of representation they wanted for the film's antagonist, the Xenomorph. And they began asking the studio to hire him as a designer. But 20th Century Fox initially thought that Giger's work was too ghastly for audiences. But Brandywine really, really wanted Giger, so they were persistent and eventually able to bring him on.
Good. That was the best thing they could have done, I think, for the aesthetic.
So as far as a couple of things about those contributions to the design. There's obviously the face hugger, which was the first creature that Geiger designed for the film. And he gave it these like giant human-like fingers and a long tail, and very disturbing when it jumps out of that egg onto Kane.
It's so
it's
gross.
Super scary.
It's so gross.
It's a great like jump scare in the film. Mm-hmm. And then there's the chest burster. That's what it's referred to. And this is a very iconic scene that everyone, like when you think about Alien, or I think they did a poll of a bunch of people, and like the one thing they always remember is this chest burster scene. So the chest burster was shoved up through the table and a false torso by a puppeteer. The scene has been recognized as one of the film's most memorable, and the design of the chest burster was inspired by Francis Bacon's 1944 painting, Three Studies, Four Figures at the Base of a Crucifixion.
Oh,
so I was like,
no.
Okay. And for the filming of the chest burster scene, the cast members knew that the creature would be bursting out of Hurt's body. And they had seen the chest burster puppet, but they had not been told that fake blood would be bursting out in every direction from high pressure pumps and squibs. So the scene was shot in one take using an artificial torso filled with blood and viscera, with Hurt's head and arms coming up from underneath the table. And the blood startled Cartwright so badly that when she falls over and goes into hysterics in the film, that's a real reaction.
Yeah, it looks real. It sounds real. The way she says, "Oh my God," it's authentic.
Yep. And the whole cast, all of their responses and reactions are completely authentic, and it really adds to the scene, I think. So it's really, really good. And it's still hard to watch to this day. I actually, when I turned Alien back on last night, it's one of those things where I have a few horror films that are sort of like my comfort films, so I can turn it on and fall asleep to it. Not in a it bores me way, but like in a I'm comforted by this film. And I'm just listening to the chest bursting scene with my eyes closed kind of thing. So Ron Cobb came up with the idea that the creature could have a powerful acid for blood. And I think this is really cool. The characteristic would carry over to the adult alien and would make it impossible for the crew to kill it by conventional means. So things like guns or explosives, since the acid would burn through the ship's hull. It really adds this extra element of having to be creative in horror to survive. But it doesn't mean that it's impossible. But I really like that element of the acid blood, because it's not necessarily something that the alien seems to utilize as a mechanism for killing anyone, but it's a defense mechanism. It's a survival.
Yes.
It's about the survival of their species.
Anything
evolution.
Anything that can take away the ability to hurt it, I think, is very scary, just on a human instinct level. You know, it's the rule of the more guns you have, the more impossible this thing must be. And especially in Alien, where they're not space marines. They're a bunch of, you know, average Joes who work on a mining, you know.
Yeah, it's a mining vessel.
Yeah, so the fact that they even have any weapons, you know, you still know they don't stand a chance. It doesn't matter, you know. Just
well, and on this particular vessel, they don't have any weapons. They have these flamethrower things.
I thought they had like one gun, but maybe that was right. It was because now that I think about it, they don't fire at once.
Yeah. I don't think they have any guns. It's all these flamethrowers that those two mechanical like engineers put together.
Yeah, it's very bleak. It's so bleak.
So, and that's just, it adds to it. It's like, oh, we had to get creative and we had to figure out, well, what are we going to do to fight this thing? Like, how do we fight it? I think someone even asked that question, and it's like, okay, well, you guys can put these things together quickly. Engineer some flamethrowers.
Ripley's very clever. Very clever.
We'll get some things done. So for the scene in which Ash is revealed to be an android, a puppet was created of the character's torso and upper body, which was operated from underneath again. And during a preview screening of the film, the scene caused an usher to faint.
It's, to be fair, it's gross.
I don't know, because whatever they use for the white android blood, it's like chalky, like if you threw flour on someone and then put water on it.
Yeah, it looks like milk, which, oh, by the way, speaking of little things
I
like
think
that.
Milk was used in some of these cases. There's so much creativity that goes into practical effects in
absolutely
these older sci-fi and horror films that is part of the reason they hold up and I love them so
yeah
much.
Like Ridley Scott was great at that. I mean, he used everything he could to make it as gross as possible, and I think he really succeeded in that vision of making it gross. And like, there's a scene where Ash, the only time you see Ash eat or drink is one scene where he picks up what looks like a glass of milk and drinks it, and it hit me when I watched it. I was like, wait a minute, oh God, he's not drinking milk. He's drinking whatever fills his android insides,
yeah,
that are also
like,
really gross. They blew my brains away.
Fluid,
yeah,
that keeps the inner workings going.
Yeah, but before you know, you're like, oh, I guess this guy really likes milk.
And Geiger made several conceptual paintings of the adult alien before settling on a final version. So what I had read is that he sculpted the creature's body using plasticine, incorporating pieces such as vertebrae from snakes and cooling tubes from a Rolls Royce. I was like, okay, so yeah, it does kind of look like a car. I'm just waiting for someone to actually make the alien car that probably resembles the Batmobile a little bit.
That'd be so cool. I wonder if that exists. I'm going to have to do a Google after
we'll
this.
We'll have to look. And then the creature's head was manufactured separately by Carlo Rambaldi, who had worked on the aliens in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. To create the moving parts, a system of hinges and cables was used to operate the creature's rigid tongue, which protruded from its mouth and featured a second mouth as its tip with its own set of movable teeth. So the final head had about like 900 moving parts.
Oh my goodness.
And points of articulation, which I'm like, that is like really intricate. And there's also part of a human skull that was used as the face and was hidden under the smooth, translucent cover of the head.
Oh, like a real one? Did they poltergeist it? They just had, oh my goodness.
That was really common though. So people like, you know, just donating themselves to those kinds of things.
Yeah.
So
what a wild
human
time to make
bodies
film.
Were moved or had been used in productions for a really long time. So we actually just talked about this on a recent episode about poltergeist. So I was like, yeah, this is actually common. It's, and as far as we know, nobody from the film Alien is cursed. So for most of the xenomorph scenes, the alien was portrayed by Balaji Bandejo. So a latex costume was made to fit his slender 6'10" frame by taking a full body plaster cast of it. So Scott had commented later that the alien takes on elements of the host, in this case, a man. So I thought that was really interesting, because are there points in the other films where we see the alien take on different shapes of different hosts, or have we only seen humans? I feel like there is an instance of this, but I can't pinpoint it.
You do see it actually less in the films, maybe in the third one. I black out a lot of the third film, if I'm completely honest with you. But I think there maybe is one dog or cat, but I think that might be the comics. So the comics and the novels dive into that concept a lot deeper than the films do.
I thought
yeah,
it's not as much in the films. We're really focused on the survival of the human race in the films.
Yeah, so. I think there's one famous instance of, like, I want to say it's like a cow or a horse. There's some weird aliens that happen in one of the, it might be when they take over Earth. I can't remember what that story is called, but it might be Hive Earth actually, but anyway. It gets weird. It gets real weird.
Well, Scott chose not to show the full alien for most of the film, keeping most of its body in shadow to create a sense of terror and heighten the suspense, so the audience could project their own fears into imagining what the rest of the creature might look like. And I think constantly changing what the creature looked like as it evolved into its adult form also added to the suspense, like, immensely. And I think that's one thing that Roger Ebert actually praised it for. Actually, we're about to talk about it now. The alien creature in the film has been referred to as one of the most iconic movie monsters in film history, and I could definitely agree with that.
Absolutely.
It's partly for its biomechanical appearance and sexual overtones, which have been frequently noted. So Roger Ebert, who hates horror films, right? We all know this for the most part. Roger Ebert hated horror films. He actually made a statement in his review about the sexual overtones of the creature design. So he had said that the first time we get a good look at the alien as it bursts from the chest of Kane, played by John Hurt, it is unmistakably phallic in shape, and the critic Tim Dirks actually mentions its open, dripping vaginal mouth. And I was like, wow, when you think about it that way, I mean, I always thought the creature looked phallic, but I was just like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
okay, Tim Dirks. But according to an article about the sexual imagery in Alien by The Take, storytellers in horror have often intertwined sex and scares to terrify audiences, and filmmakers use sex to make their audiences uncomfortable, and the guys who made Alien weren't really any different. And there's a few quotes from this article that I wanted to dive into with you really quickly. So in the 2002 TV documentary, The Alien Saga, Alien screenwriter Dan O'Bannon had explained that he's going to attack the audience and he's going to attack them sexually. And I was like, well, okay, that's an interesting quote. But I think it's with sexuality. And at the time, that's pretty daring, I think.
Yeah,
in 1979, right?
Absolutely. And then, you know, when you think about how the characters are presented, how the monsters are presented, even down to like the corporate overtones of it. Mm. Like 1969 was not that far away from 1979.
Right.
You know, you had riots, you had this era of rebellion, of exploration, of finally being like, you know what? Screw the norms. we're doing it this way. And I think Alien encapsulates a lot of that for the time as well. So I think that's definitely on the right track. You know, there's something very rebellious about the way they did it for the time, especially.
Yeah, I have to say, like, yeah, there's a lot going on, and it's interesting that they went this route. But O'Bannon, with him writing the script and Geiger designing both the set and the monster, it should really come as no surprise that Alien is basically one big metaphor for sex, pregnancy, and even sexual assault in several instances. So the entire movie is filled with phallic and vaginal imagery, from gaping doorways to phallic ships. And the xenomorph itself has an incredibly phallic head and its long, stiff second mouth.
The face
hugger, which is used to penetrate its prey. Even the face hugger, yeah. And in this case, the phallic head of the xenomorph is more or less the world's most dangerous erection, is what this person had said in their article. And I was like, yeah, pretty much. And they go on to say that, you know, sexual assault is one of the worst crimes imaginable. And so films that feature sexual violence like this often leave a permanent mark on our, you know, collective memories. And I said, yeah, that's true. And the way that they did it in this is where you don't even realize it's happening.
Ooh, it's insidious. It's very insidious. And it's funny because, again, it's one of those things that was not explicit in the film while being quite explicit. They did it just enough where, you know, there's a scene, one of the, when I think of that side of it, I think of the scene where the tail is going up Lambert's leg. But then it cuts. You don't see anything happen. You don't need to. It's there, and it's chilling in the way it sits with your gut while it pans to Ripley. It's just very, very effective horror.
Yeah,
I got goosebumps
very
like
scary.
Thinking about it.
And we talked about the title sequence that was developed by Greenberg Associates to instill a sense of foreboding. The letters broken into pieces, the space between them very unsettling. So it's referenced, like I said, as one of the most iconic opening sequences of all time. So it's really interesting because it's all text and space. So
yeah, that's all they needed. Alien is one of those films that is horror from the tip of its head all the way down to its very tippy toes. I don't think there's a line, a single frame in Alien that isn't meant to do that to you. And it's just so, again, it's so effective down to literally the lettering. You're like, I don't feel good about this.
And the film was a commercial success, like we talked about. It opened in 90 theaters across the U.S. and Canada, and it set 51 house records, grossing well over like $3.5 million over the four-day Memorial weekend, which Daily Variety had suggested might have been the biggest per-screen opening in history. So in 1992, Fox had noted that the worldwide gross was like $143 million or something like that.
Ooh.
It's a lot.
That's
which
a lot.
Is funny because we're going to get into something interesting here. It took 7 years for the sequel to Alien to be released due to legal disputes. So despite this apparent box office success, 20th Century Fox claimed that in the 11 months since its release on May, what did we say? It came out May 25th, 1979, right? They had said that Alien had lost the studio $2 million. So this was seen as an example of Hollywood creative accounting being used by Fox to disguise the film revenue and limit any payments to Brandywine, who produced the film. So the claim was criticized by industry accountants, and by August 1980, Fox had readjusted the figure to a profit of $4 million, although this was similarly refuted by them, I guess. But Brandywine was eager to start work on the sequel, so they sued Fox over their profit distribution tactics, and Fox claimed that Alien was not a financial success and did not warrant a sequel. So it's interesting, but the lawsuit was settled in 1983, and Fox, at that time, Fox agreed to fund Aliens, which is the sequel to Alien. And in 1986, we finally got to see the continuing story of Ellen Ripley and the Xenomorph. So that is why it took 7 years for the sequel to get made.
I can't believe that corporate greed, the movie about corporate greed, was almost foiled by the corporate greed of Fox and the lawsuits.
Now, do you wonder if some of the script was maybe influenced by that whole situation?
Oh God, yeah. No, I had no idea about that. That's really fascinating when you look at the context of especially the second film. Oh no.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. So before we get into talking about our favorite scenes and stuff, I do have a little bit more here. I do want to make note of a couple of things. So first, let's take a minute to talk about the Nostromo. I read a really interesting quote in Groovy History that said that the Nostromo itself is built like a haunted house. So its dark depths contain corridors to nowhere, air ducts in which even the ship's captain can get lost, and a room with nothing but chains hanging from the ceiling. It's ugly and dirty. It's both surreal and organic at the same time. In Alien, the dream of retrofuturism is over. So I thought that was really interesting because I'd never had anyone sort of compare it to a haunted house before. So I'm curious what you thought about that.
I absolutely agree. It's so funny because I was like, why is there? Hold on. And it was questions that I had never really asked myself before, because, you know, usually you just sit and you're like, yay, I don't care why. But looking at it, I was like, all right, why is the ship so huge? And why is there a room for of chains, and it's raining? Where is this rain coming from?
I'm curious, where's the cargo? Because they're returning from their mining expedition. And
right.
Thinking that giant room with just the chains hanging down where Brett and Parker are, that's where the cargo would be.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a mechanical engineering deck. I don't know.
I would like to have words with the engineers though who built this ship. But it really is, and it's so claustrophobic. And I mean, even the sounds that it makes is also, I think, part of that haunted house feel to it. The way when they're going through the vents, the way they close in like these metal spirals, and they clinch close. It kind of, if you speaking of perverseness in the film, kind of look like buttholes, and they make the worst grinding metal sound you can think of.
I need to go back and watch it again. Yeah. Like,
I don't
remember seeing a butthole when the men closed behind Dallas, but
it doesn't close all the way, so there's like a hole in the middle, right? And it's kind of like, I don't know, but I watched it and I was like, am I just
that
like too tired watching it?
Film.
but and then it closes off, right? So then you close off all your escape routes, and they're trying to, you know, steer this alien into this one spot of the ship, and it's impossible because the ship is nightmare built, and it's absolutely purposeful, absolutely horror house. It's just terrifying.
And then, so this was interesting. I had no idea about this. Alien originally was to conclude with the destruction of the Nostromo while Ripley escapes in the shuttle. However, Ridley Scott conceived of a fourth act to the film in which the alien appears on the shuttle and Ripley is forced to confront it. So we do that. That happens, right? So that this confrontation happens. But originally, he pitched the idea to 20th Century Fox. And negotiated an increase in the budget to the film so that the scene could be shot, because he needed several extra days. Now, originally, Scott wanted the alien to bite off Ripley's head and then make the final log entry in her voice. But the producers vetoed the idea as they believed the alien should die at the end of the film. So can you imagine if our final girl, our badass, non-binary Ellen Ripley had died at the end of Alien?
I think we wouldn't be talking about this film if that had been the ending, to be quite honest. It would have,
like, it's signaling this alien's higher intelligence, eats her head, and then in her voice makes that log entry at the end. That's one of Scott's like less inspired ideas, in my opinion.
When you're a creative, you win some, you lose some.
That would have been awful, and we wouldn't be talking about it. And think of the franchise we wouldn't have, or the Predator crossover. Like, we wouldn't have any of those things.
And where would we be without the crossover between Predator and Alien?
We wouldn't have Alexa Woods, another great final girl. But I also wanted to talk about, and this is something that came up for me today, the queer factor in this film. So I asked myself the question, is Alien a queer film, and just how queer is it? I asked myself that question today while I was, you know, prepping to talk to you. And in doing so, I found a lot of great articles. There's a great article by Danny Lever exploring the question, you know, from Facehuggers to Phallic Tales, is Alien one of the queerest films ever? And in my personal opinion, yeah, it is a queer film. If you examine it closely through a queer lens, it's really obvious. And I'll be quoting a lot of Lever's article here just for a moment as we explore this. And I'd love to get your response and opinions on some of these things. So like you said, we did say the article is very hard hitting. It's like, but, you know, there are some good points. So one of the things, this kind of quote that I thought was, it sums it up, is that Ridley Scott's Alien is a queer text throughout. It explores notions of gender norms and stereotypes, gender neutrality, sexuality, and bodies. So, like, I can agree with that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But Ridley Scott's Alien is often renowned as, you know, one of the first feminist sci-fi films. The film is also super queer. So not only is Ellen Ripley the strong androgynous femme fatale we can all swoon over. Now, I don't know if I agree with that statement. It is also a film that, according to David McGinty, author of the Alien study Beautiful Monsters, plays very deliberately with male fears of female reproduction. So the male characters are emasculated in various ways, suffering blows to their male ego, or experiencing things women are expected to. Through a queer film theorist lens, this film explores gender, sexuality, and bodies in a way that was revolutionary for, you know, that time and today. So there's things in that statement I can definitely agree with, but at the same time, I've never thought of Ripley as a femme fatale.
It is funny. And it's easy, I think, to think of her that way when you think of, you know, the Ripley in the exosuit, you know.
Yeah.
Get
I guess
away from
I've,
her,
I've
you
never
bitch,
sexualized
right?
her.
Yeah, even I never, you don't really, and she's not presented in a way that I think is you're supposed to, you know, she feels very natural to me. And that's what I always loved about Ripley. So Ripley just is. She's not there for anyone but herself. And they do a really great job of showing that in her character and how she speaks to people. So I definitely agree in that sense of, you know, she is this icon. She absolutely is this icon. But Femme Fatale seems very strange.
I think you're in this other box of like, okay, well, I've sexualized her at this point. So to me, she's a femme fatale. She's
right.
I don't know, a badass that I'd like to fuck. I don't really see
even
no offense to the author of this article, but like this is kind of the thing because they also bring up like when Alien came out in 1979, this was a time where being a woman on screen meant you were often scantily clad or a damsel in distress. For the Ripley character, she's not stripped down to her underwear until the last, you know, few moments of the film in this climactic scene with the xenomorph. And it is kind of an odd scene, like, that they chose at this time to her down and have her be naked. And there's a little bit of butt crack going on
that,
there.
That was one of the things I actually disagreed with most in this article. That one scene. It's very interesting to me that Ripley is put in this position of, you know, this queer non-binary character, however, you know, you wanted to frame her as, while also at the same time sexualizing her. And that to me, it's just interesting to look at it that way. For me, after a long, hard day, I take off my shirt and I take off my pants.
I get comfortable and vulnerable. And that's what I felt when I'm looking at that scene is like, okay, this is Ripley. She's finally relaxed and at her most vulnerable. And this is the moment when she realizes, oh, fuck, the alien's here.
Yeah, she's like, completely alone. And then to me, it's not about it. It fits perfectly within the film. It makes sense to me. It drives home the point of being home and alone and vulnerable and finally getting comfortable. She's, you know, on her way home and then having an intruder that you'd never noticed before. And that to me is just like that's a quintessential theme.
And I have
Alien.
To say, like, regardless of how small her panties are in that scene, her attire really wasn't a big focal point in the scene itself. So I didn't take that from it.
No, she immediately gets into a spacesuit. She gets more covered than she has been the whole film.
So, but this I have to agree with. The crew are constructed as sort of gender neutral through the use of identical genderless uniforms and the use of only their second names. And it strips down the femininity or masculinity given through first names, but at the same time, we also see them all, not all of them, but a lot of them, scantily clad in that first scene when they come out of cryosleep. So I guess the one thing for that scene is that, like, it feels like a lot of focus on John Hurt's character and the white underpants he's wearing and the bulge. So
He was the femme fatale of the film, anything.
Maybe. but it was interesting because I go back now and I'm like, they were focusing on, you know, John Hurt's character, Kane, who is that kind of starting focal point of the film in terms of what happens with his character. So I was like, oh, it makes more sense why they're focused on him when the cryo chambers open. But Ripley's personality, from what this author says, Ripley's personality is constructed as quite neutral, and she doesn't lean into docile femininity or ego-driven masculinity. She's strong but empathetic, courageous but sensitive. She's stripped of sexuality and gender, making her a queer protagonist who deconstructs the gender norms of the time. So would you agree with that statement?
Absolutely. Yeah,
that I did agree
that
with.
I was on board with that. I was mega on board with that. It just made sense to me, and I think that goes back to what we mentioned before, how she's, you know, she's a character. They made Ripley unapologetically who they were, and for me, being queer, like, that's what it's about, is being unapologetically who you are and whatever, you know. She never had to fit a mold. She wasn't supposed to. She was just her.
Well, and I think she was a great sort of icon and role model for women at the time and even women now. And is why she stood the test of time as a fantastic character in Final Girl and
absolutely.
You know, whatever you want to call it.
There's a few. She's interesting because you can fit her. She can be, Ripley can be what you need her to be. And that's really a beauty about the character. You know, she can be this, you know, super badass femme fatale, which I think is more in the second film personally. I'll give her femme fatale in Aliens. But she can be this feminist icon. She can be this non-binary queer icon. She can be Ripley is what you need her to be. And I think that's why she's so attractive to watch and why you can watch her and really feel a connection with the character in a lot of ways. At least that's how it's always been for me and Ripley.
Yeah, I definitely have to agree with you there. And so this is another section of the film that they had spoken about. Particularly in terms of, you know, Ripley and then like the masculinity in the film. So when Ripley asserts her authority in the team after Dallas is caught by the alien, Ash, the male robot, feels threatened and attempts to dominate over Ripley to regain his masculinity. Now, that's not exactly what happened.
No.
That's not why he was attacking her. It's because she was trying to stop his mission.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Lever had said he's a genderless robot. However, he exemplifies constructed toxic masculinity, aggression, a fragile ego, and stubbornness. He attacks Ripley, who's exemplifying gender neutrality and sexual equality, by beating her, and then he shoves a porn magazine rolled up into a phallic shape down her throat, symbolically sexually assaulting her. And then a queer reading could suggest this is corrective assault to attempt to squash the queerness and sexuality of women. So the pornographic nature of the magazine suggests he is trying to make her succumb to her truth as a woman, a sexual object. The patriarchy is battling queerness here before Ash is defeated. So there, I think that's a bit of a reach.
I agree 100%. I think that's probably the biggest reach of the article for me was that section, because of the nature of his mission and the what's interesting, actually, I think, you know what? I think there is a point to be had here. Ash is basically programmed to simulate a man. At the time, I'm sure it was a huge reveal, right? No, he's so good at emulating, you know, what a computer and what a science lab thinks of a male. And that is a really interesting point, is like, so what if you take this blank slate and somebody gives you a pamphlet that says make a boy, make a man, what do you put into that program? Because he is programmed to be that. And I think, you know, I don't agree that I think he's a genderless robot. I think he very much is gendered, and I think that is a really interesting point to see, like, is this what man is when you boil it down? Like, is that a fair representation of all men? And it's not, certainly.
Right.
But it's very telling when you make a male robot and then he, you know, tries to shove a porn magazine down a woman's throat. And that, to me, that's the thoughts, you know. I don't necessarily read into it as it being a corrective assault for queerness. I actually didn't realize that it was a porn magazine until this magazine, and
I
was like,
I didn't realize either. I just knew it was a magazine.
So it's not overt in that regard, which makes me think that maybe, at least for me, was a bit of a reach.
I have to agree. There's some things about, you know, Lever brings up about toxic masculinity and things like that, and it's like, I can see how you could pull that out of the scene from the assault with the magazine.
Yeah, for sure. And it's aggressive, and it's
but
very
uncomfortable. I don't
think
it starts there. I think it ends there.
Yeah. Again, you have to think of it as being programmed, like, and to have that in it. Oh, it's so, like, it's sticky.
Yeah, and then they also mention Kane in this kind of reversal here, that Kane is attacked by the face hugger, which in a sense is an oral sexual assault, and it impregnates him through an act of sexual dominance. Mm-hmm. And then later Kane is again penetrated. I hate the word penetrated, by
it's
the way.
It's not great.
When the alien, and they say it like five times, so hold on. Penetrated when the alien bursts out through his chest in the infamously horrifying birth scene. And then Kane is the powerless male destroyed and emasculated by giving birth or being yet again penetrated as opposed to doing the penetrating. So this highlights the panic society reacts to when confronted with gender diversity and challenging stereotypes. So that was interesting because I had not quite seen the scene that way, but I can understand coming to that those conclusions.
For sure. For sure.
I can totally see Scott and O'Bannon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why they did that. Like, I would not be shocked if that's exactly the point they were trying to make. It's definitely one of those scenes where it's supposed to make you uncomfortable. Alien is supposed to make every single person on the planet uncomfortable. That's why it's one of the horror greats. And that is one way to do it. It's uncomfortable for everyone. You can't see a dude, you know, get jumped by this thing and then later some foreign creature bursts out of the chest, right? And you know, you could tell he's just so uncomfortable the whole time, and nobody thinks, you know, he's got it real rough, right?
Yeah, poor Kane.
Poor Kane probably has it one of the roughest, because nobody really, everyone thinks it's fine, and that's, I think, goes towards, you know, I would even, you know, you could say, you know, women constantly are ignored for their pain, you know, and right, saying, you know, speaking up, and then when it's too late, you know, that's when you find out, you know, when it's bursting through the chest, you go, oh, I guess something was wrong. Oops.
Right.
You know, so
I think that's an interesting way to think about it in terms of societal commentary. On these things that women deal with all the time. So.
Yeah, yeah. And it's uncomfortable for men. It's comfortable for women. It's, you know, it's a bad situation.
Yeah, but I think it also kind of points out that men can always also experience these things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That also gets ignored pretty often too. So, but Alien really queered the binaries of traditional gender.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ask me, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
So, we, the audience, only discover later in the sequel, Aliens, that Lambert was actually a trans character.
Yeah, I was waiting for that. I was like, oh, it's going to come up. I thought that was one of the coolest reveals, even though it's canonically she's trans. I was like, oh, that's rad. Again, it's the subtlety. It's just they do so much to the point where even folks who aren't queer, those themes sink into your brain and they stay with you, right? And that's the beauty of storytelling with horror, is you can bring up these concepts that if you go, hey, this person's trans, you might get pushback from the average viewer. You might get that, you know, and we see it all the time nowadays, especially that pushback, and the beauty of characters like Lambert being trans is you just accept it. Like, it's so, they just make it part of the story and part of the thread, and it's stuff that just stays with you subconsciously, I think, which is why so many of these themes that are brought up in this article, even if, you know, it's quite heavy-handed and I don't necessarily agree, it's something to think about, and it's something that you hear and you go, oh, right, of course, that scene, you know, that makes sense.
Yeah, and the reveal that Lambert is a trans character is groundbreaking even for 1986 when Aliens came out, but it's a really quick blip on the screen that you might miss as the film opens if you're not paying attention, right? So I think it's great that the character is identified as trans, but at the same time, I think it's great that we're not like, oh, well, Lambert, they're trans. It's like, no, Lambert, she's trans.
Yeah, for sure.
And we don't, because I think people are often, we're so focused on the transness of someone, we're not like, yeah, they're, but she is,
yeah,
she.
Yeah, she, so, yeah, she's
not referring to constantly to the transition, unless that's what they choose, so.
Yeah, yeah, again, it, Lambert was another character on the ship. She was there.
Right.
She was there to be who Lambert is. And there's just such a profound, very subtle boldness in that. And I love that.
And then film analyst Lena Badley has written that the alien's design has some strong Freudian sexual undertones, multiple phallic symbols, and overall has a feminine figure, and it provides an androgynous image conforming to archetypical mappings and imageries in horror films that often redraw gender lines, which I thought was an interesting comment. So. Ripley and this, we talked a little bit about the final girl stuff, but Ellen Ripley, Ripley is this wonderful final girl representation that doesn't hold to the stereotypical mold of the final girls of 1980s slashers, you know, which is great. In 1979, maybe they just made it right under the cusp. I don't know. But I'm sad that this final girl character did not influence more final girl characters in the 80s. So, and that's something I kind of think about because she's this boundary busting heroine, to quote Kate Erblond of IndieWire, who had a lot of great points about what makes Ripley a great final girl. So I want to talk about some of those.
Yes, I'd love that.
But yeah, I'm curious what you think about that, because we really don't see any other, these like strong sort of almost non-binary characters
for sure
in these 80s slashers, where we kind of flip it and women become extremely sexualized throughout that whole decade.
Yeah, that decade they were big into the grindhouse, you know, style, you know, Halloween, all of that, Nightmare on Elm Street, very very sexual, very young sexual,
and timid too.
Yeah,
don't have strong, bold.
Yeah, I think
female characters like Nancy Thompson, I think, kind of goes there a little bit, Nancy's, but she's still quite reserved.
Nancy's great. It's she's very meek. You see it in the newest Halloween. They brought her back and they gave her oh goodness, oh help me with the name. I can't remember
Laurie
her name.
Strode?
Yes, with the
I didn't know if
thank
you're talking
you.
About her or a different character in Halloween. Laurie Strode.
Yeah, Laurie Strode comes back and they Ripley her up in the latest film. Like, and
she is Ripley'd up. She's seen some shit. She's prepared now.
Right? I want to see more older women kickassery in these films in general. But I think that's what makes Alien so special and so unique and so stand out in the world of the slasher films is there really one of the only ones who did it, and it's you know, I think the influences are there. I don't think they're as overt as Ripley was, but I think you see her even outside of horror film. I see when was the first Terminator? I think the first Terminator was after.
And it was in the 80s.
Yeah. So, you know, I see her in The Terminator. I see her in a lot of action films. She ended up being, I think, influenced mostly in,
she's
like,
an action heroine.
Right. Thanks, Aliens.
And then Scott's choice to center Alien around the strength of a female character in the late 1970s was pretty groundbreaking. We all think about that. The character was originally written by O'Bannon as a male lead, but Scott decided to change the character to a woman. Best choice he ever made.
Yeah, hands down. I mean, that's what I mean.
So a female badass like Ripley was something new. It was something bold, and Weaver and Scott made good on the promise of such a character, and she's still one of the most memorable and enduring heroines ever. She will continue to be as long as we are presenting Alien to, you know, future generations. So I hope that we never stop showing it to people, and I hope that we never remake it and said just re-release the film in theaters.
Yeah, please. Oh goodness, please.
So Ripley becomes this de facto leader who is forced into this heroic position that she soon discovers suits her really well. So in early moments in the film, Ripley is this curious, brash, outspoken, and unafraid person. She'll voice her opinions to either Dallas or Ash in the midst of the facehugger incident on the planet. That has dialed up the crew's anxiety everywhere else, but she's keeping quite a level head. Well, obviously she's anxious too, but I think able to act. So, and she's just as human as the rest of the crew, sans Ash, obviously. She's just as terrified, but she's also the only person who can persevere in the face of seemingly insurmountable odds. So Ripley's fear is most palpable during her final face-off with her alien intruder. So like you said, think of it like that. It's like you just got home, you're relaxing, and there's an intruder hiding in your closet, basically. It's hard to marry wide-eyed terror with the swagger to carry an actual flamethrower, but Weaver does it in style. And Alien concludes with its heroine proving victorious while still knowing full well that she's had to sacrifice a lot to get there. So that's really genius, and it's what makes Ripley so great. And the full embodiment of a strong female character who also doesn't shy away from the characteristics that keep her human and relatable. Now, that's something we talk about a lot when we're like, oh, strong female character, because, and this is something, I even have a shirt that I got at, I think, PAX East, and I got it up in the lounge from an LGBTQ booth. It says strong female character on it.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, and it's, because oftentimes people like to think that being a strong female character, that it strips away your femininity, or that you need to be presented one particular way to be feminine or a woman, or
poppycock.
There's all these societal ideals and stuff like that. So, and I'm like, no, that's not the case. It doesn't need to be that way. That's just a societal norm that's been baked into your thinking.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So she saves the world. She saves herself, at least for now. She saves her cat. She still finds the time to craft one last log entry to tell the world that this thing has transpired and what she's done to keep the monsters at bay for that time period. So I think it's great.
Yeah, absolutely. She's the embodiment of sometimes you got to have a cry and you take care of business. And Ripley continues to do that throughout the entire film. And I love that she carries this flamethrower. She does what she needs to do. And she cries multiple times throughout Alien. You know, she just breaks down because the horror of the situation is just overwhelming. And the difference between her and, let's say, Lambert has her cry, she's paralyzed by it, absolutely, and that ultimately is,
yeah, she's unable to act and move through it,
right? And whereas Ripley, you know, she has her cry while, you know, hitting the trigger of a flamethrower, like, you know, I aspire to that strength of womanhood.
Yeah.
And that strength period to, you know, have that, you know, because sometimes it's overwhelming, and that's great. And I think, yeah, you know, I'd like to see that in all characters more often.
Yeah.
is the tough guy who, you know, has his cry, takes care of business.
Yeah, there we go. That's a well-rounded character right there.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of Ripley is she's everything. She's everything. And all the characters I've ever loved in my life are pieces of everything. And that's what makes her so special.
And before we jump into the kill count, I wanted to talk about the cultural influences of Alien. So this is a huge film. It had a huge impact on science fiction. So Alien had both an immediate and long-term impact on the science fiction and horror genres. And many films tried to cash in on the success of Alien by using similar themes or changing the titles of their names before their film came out. And putting like Alien in the name. So I thought that was interesting. And you might know about this. So Nintendo's long-running Metroid video game series, created in 1986, same time that the sequel Aliens came out, was significantly influenced by Alien, both in stylistic and thematic elements. In acknowledging the homage to Alien, villains in the first Metroid installment were named were actually named Ripley and Mother Brain after the movie's director, and the ship computer, respectively. Or excuse me, Ridley, not Ripley.
Yeah, you can see it's in a lot of sci-fi.
It makes me wonder if Ridley Scott was like, what are we going to name her? What if we just put a P instead of a D?
Right, right. Can we just
call her Ripley?
Ripley, done. Iconic.
That's why I literally just confused their names when I was reading. I was it's like, easy. Oh, man. And then Ty Frank, one of the authors behind the sci-fi series The Expanse, which apparently is great, and I have not had the time to watch it yet, credits Alien as one of his major inspirations. Mm-hmm.
I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any sci-fi after Alien that hasn't had at least a little influence. Hell, you'll be hard pressed to find a Halloween special in a TV show that doesn't have some kind of alien reference.
Well, and you're gonna get a lot of alien references that have different like hive aspects to them, or you know, with the mother brood and the egg and that kind of thing. You actually see it in my favorite of the Stargate universe stuff with Stargate Atlantis. So you have the Wraith, and they have hive motherships, and there's a mother Wraith aboard, and then like cocooned eggs of all the other Wraith. And like, so it's kind of the same sort of premise.
Yeah.
Because there's like the mother xenomorph, right?
Yeah. Talk about a film that really screwed up motherhood for everyone. They really, like, even the ship, you know, called Mother, is perverse in her own way. Like, even down to that, it was just, I think it really kicked off that whole, that is, I don't remember seeing anything
when,
before that,
Ash
right?
Ash says, Dallas, Mother wants to talk to you. It's just like, what?
Yeah.
And it's the ship. And,
yeah. It's very strange.
And Mother is the corporate arm of the Nostromo.
Yeah, yeah. She talks like an old grandma while counting down a detonation.
Well, one of the things that we do, well, actually, let's get into the kill count.
All right.
So, kill count, 7 deaths in this film, including the xenomorph. So we have Kane, Brett, Dallas, Ash, Lambert, Parker, and the xenomorph. And Parker, when we see Parker die, we don't even really see Parker die, but Parker helps to ensure Ripley's escape to the escape vessel, the other ship. He gets in the alien's way. They were going together. They found each other. They were headed there together, but he distracts the alien so that Ripley can get there. But the weird, to me, that's the one continuity issue, is like, well, how the fuck did it get on the space shuttle then?
Yeah, I had that same
it's
thought,
the fourth act.
Right? You know what I thought? Hold on, I have a theory that it's a superior being.
It's while she was looking for the cat.
And I think that it predicted where she was going to go. Because if there's a second, the alien does something that makes it.
She had started up that, she had prepped the ship. She had started up so it was a warm.
He checks the coolant. Space. The alien looks at the coolant. And I think in that moment, it seems like he has a thought. And the alien, I think he hides, and he just is like, I'm going to be a cupboard until she checks
that,
on this.
Well, there's that. But at the same time, the way that he's tucked in there all warm, like it's a womb, I feel like it was like, oh, well, I gravitated to this warm place that was a little warmer, or somewhere where I could tuck away and relax after dealing with all these fucking assholes in my way on the ship after being born. And I just need to rest for a little bit. And he's asleep in the
he kind of takes
the wires and
listen, she takes forever to get
like
on there.
Baby.
Yeah, he does a little baby. The sounds he makes is even a little baby sound when she's, you know, coolanting him. it's very kind of a child scream. All the little details. You don't notice it when you're terrified as a child and you watch it as an adult and you're like, oh, this is worse. I should have been scared for totally different reasons.
Yes, definitely. Well, one of the things we like to do to conclude a lovely movie chat here is to talk about the bloody knives we want to rate the movie with. So I give Alien 5 out of 5 bloody knives. You get 5 bloody knives and you can rate a film based on acting, performances, overall atmosphere, gore, script, all that good stuff, direction, cinematography, whatever floats your boat. Consider it like a 5-star rating system, it's bloody knives here, so.
Bloody knives.
How would you rate the film?
I would rate it a bloody knife for every death in the that's how much I like it. I know you said five, so I guess five. I would say five. Yeah, five. But if I could give it 1,000 more, I would.
We conclude that this is a fantastic film. Yes. And it's really there's not a lot of negatives in this film for me. I don't even know if I can think of one.
No, the only negative I had was I was like, why is there a chain room? Like, that was my biggest question. Yeah. Is why
Which
is there
I just kind of I let the weird.
Yeah, right. But the beauty of sci-fi is you're not supposed to question it. And that's the beauty of storytelling horror is you don't need to. You don't need to question it. It is what it is. You're along for the ride. Even if that ride is terrifying and gory, it's all of it.
Yeah, it's scary. And it just I don't know. I just love watching this film, and it's so good every time. And it really does transcend time. And like we said, with the heroine also, it's a fantastic film. And hopefully you've seen it before we talked about all this stuff.
Yes, so, spoiler alert.
Timber, thank you so much for coming and hanging out with me today and chatting horror with me on Slayaway, especially talking about Alien and going down all these awesome exploratory roads with me. I really do appreciate it, and I hope to have you back again soon.
Yeah, would love to. Thank you so much for having me, too. This was awesome, and thanks for getting me to think about Alien in a way I have never really dove into. Very, very enlightening.
Final report of the commercial starship Nostromo. Third officer reporting. The other members of the crew. Kane, Lambert, Parker, Brett, Ash, and Captain Dallas are dead. Cargo and ship destroyed. I should reach the frontier in about 6 weeks. With a little luck, the network will pick me up. This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.
Slayers, did you enjoy that episode? If you like the podcast, we encourage you to head over to Podchaser and leave us a review. The best part is it helps put Slayaway in the hands of more horror fans.